Welcome to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Hosted by Beth Burschak, with expert advice from Jim Lang, Pittsburgh-based CPA, attorney, and retirement and estate planning expert. Jim is also the author of Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. To find out more about his book, his practice, Lang Financial Group, and how to secure Jim as a speaker for your next event, visit his website at retiresecure.com. Now, get ready to talk smart money.
We are talking smart money, and thank you so much for joining us tonight. I'm Beth Burschak, along with Jim Lang, CPA, attorney, best-selling author of two editions of the book Retire Secure, Pay Taxes Later. And our guest tonight, Charlie Smith, Principal and Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group. And we are going to be doing a lot of talking about the current market environment tonight. First of all, Charlie, I have to mention that you were in the Post-Gazette this morning, quoted in, if you went to the business section, the very front page had a big article called "In an Uncertain Economy, What Could Be Safer Than a Pile of Money?" And go about midway through the article, and Charlie is quoted in there. And you actually say that smart money will stay invested in stocks. Can you explain that?
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the chance to come on with you. I didn't even see that article today, but our basic philosophy at Fort Pitt Capital Group is that over time there is such a thing as the equity premium. That is, you're going to be paid to be an investor in businesses. And, you know, the rage right now, particularly after the debacle in the financial markets last year, is to, you know, sit on a pile of cash, as is depicted in the article. And, you know, the Fed and the Treasury are doing everything they can right now to try to get people out of cash investments. They push the rates on cash down to zero. Most money market funds are paying almost zero. So it really behooves investors to think about the returns that are available in a cash investment, essentially zero, and try to move out the risk spectrum, move out the maturity spectrum a little bit to take a little bit of risk, because you're not getting paid to sit on cash.
I do know people that sat on cash, not only sat on cash, but essentially cashed out.
Mm-hmm. When? That's the big question.
In the spring.
Okay.
So if you did that, you're probably missing some of the recovery.
Well, the issue is, when you make a decision to either go all in or all out, depending on your age. I mean, if you're 95 years old and, you know, you're essentially coming to the end of your investing life, that's one thing. But if you're a younger person, anywhere between 25 and 60, say, to go all out, you're going to have to make another good decision at some point to get back in. And we find it hard enough to make one good decision. So the problem compounds itself. The issue for us is not all out or all in. It's building a portfolio of reasonably well-run businesses that we pay a reasonable price for. So we're not necessarily worried about making the all-in or all-out call. It's owning businesses that we know we have done the work on and understand and have paid a reasonable price for.
Now, essentially, if you're looking at the past months, March was the bottom. Am I right? Were we at the bottom in March?
Yes, that's right.
And then do you guys think, Jim and Charlie, do you both think that was the bottom, or do you think there's still a bottom to come?
That's a Charlie question, not a Jim question.
We had our investment policy committee meeting on Tuesday morning, and one of the things I said was, we're not going back to 666 on the S&P. That was where we closed on March 6th. And I would put the odds on some sort of a cataclysmic event in the financial system that could drive us back there at less than 1 in 5. And those are pretty low odds. And primarily because, as I mentioned in the PG article today, the policymakers are continuing to do absolutely everything they can to support the financial system, including the Fed basically printing $800 billion to $1 trillion, the Treasury borrowing hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars to put into the financial system to support it. So when you've got the power of the printing press working against a apocalyptic collapse like some people are still expecting, I think the odds on that are pretty low.
Is it fair to say that if you do have your money in cash and CDs and money markets and low-yield fixed-income type investments, that people think that that is safe, but in reality, that is not a protection against taxes and inflation? And is it fair to say that the risk, if you will, even though it's more predictable, that inflation could actually be a bigger danger than losing money in the markets.
Yes. I think if you look at the historic levels of annualized return from equities, long-term corporate bonds, long-term treasuries, and short-term cash investments, you will see that over an extended time period, cash investments earn you no real return. And then when you put a tax rate on those cash investments, you're ending up behind inflation. So the only real way to protect the value of your assets over time is to own assets which compound at some rate well above the risk-free rate. And you want to own pieces of businesses. You know, there's a reason that the list of people on the Forbes 400 doesn't include people who own bonds or money market funds. It's because the way that you build wealth over time is to accumulate a little bit of capital, add your labor and management expertise, and compound it. You know, the value is added in the human interaction and the human input.
Well, some of the comments that I get from some of my clients say, in their, let's say, 60s and 70s, are, well, yes, I understand, and you show me these graphs that show that over the long period that the market returns much higher than a cash or even a treasury bond mm-hmm. or a CD. But gee, Jim, I don't know how many years I have left. Can I afford to take the risk of the market going down substantially, and I don't have enough years to invest, and on top of that, I'm using my current investments as the source of my lifestyle?
Sure. We obviously have many clients who are in exactly that position, and our response to those people is you figure out what your investment horizon is. Even if you're 65 and just about to retire, the actuaries will tell you that you're going to live another 23, 25 years. So you may retire, but you can't afford to retire your money. What we do for people in that position is say, what are your cash flow needs? How much cash do you need from the portfolio every year? Let's set aside 3 to 5 years worth of your cash flow need in cash today, ready cash, so that we can take that segment of the portfolio and put it aside and not have to worry about it, so that if we do get a 5-year downturn or maybe even a 10-year downturn as we've seen since 1999 in the S&P 500, a client, you know, the S&P's gone nowhere for 10 years essentially. You get an environment like that, at least the first five years of that downturn, you know, you're not going to have to be taking money out when the market is potentially at a bottom. So.
Charlie, you just said that have X amount of ready cash, X amount of months. Should you be doing that anyway, or are you just talking about this particular situation?
No, it depends on your two things. It depends on your risk tolerance. We have some clients with us who are 85 years old and are withdrawing, you know, 4 or 5% of their portfolio, well, maybe 4% of their portfolio a year, and they have 70 to 80% of their portfolio in stocks. Because they recognize that, you know, they've got a time horizon that may be beyond 6, 7, 8 years. And, you know, historically, you know, the period we've seen the last 10 years is very unusual. And with the ability to ride through the slings and arrows of an up and down market, you're going to earn more money over time. So,
And for that person, let's say for somebody in their 80s, for example, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think we've all heard of, well, you take your age and you subtract it from 100, and that's how much bonds and that's how much stocks, but which obviously I think doesn't have very much merit. But I would say that for a lot of those people, and particularly that generation, they don't tend to be great spenders. So sometimes 4% withdrawal rate of their portfolio is well above what they are currently spending.
Exactly.
And in that case, ultimately, you're not really investing for somebody in their mid-80s. You're investing for somebody in their maybe 40s or however old their children are.
Exactly. You're investing for the next generation, and their time horizon is 40, 50, 60 years. If you think in terms of a 40-year-old maybe needing the funds when they're 70 or 75, you have at least a 35-year horizon from there. So, yes, people with substantial assets and the can see down the road the ability to pass those assets on, the time horizon on those monies is inherited by the next generation, so it's longer.
And can I also take it that you take into account somebody's situation? So, for example, let's say somebody has a pension or they are a teacher and they are getting a guaranteed income from the state, and let's say Social Security, do you say, well, you can kind of look at that as the guaranteed or the fixed income portion of the portfolio, and therefore, even if normally that what might be appropriate is a 50% stock, 50% bond, but if they have a pension or Social Security, that you could have significantly more
equity exposure.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You can take whatever pension benefit or Social Security benefit that you're going to be receiving and plug it in as the part of the cash flow portion or the fixed income portion of your portfolio. We have a lot of customers who are entrepreneurs and have sort of funded their own retirement, so they're living only off their investments plus Social Security. They don't necessarily have a corporate pension, but that's certainly an ingredient in deciding what fraction of your portfolio should be in stocks. If you can see a substantial Social Security payment and a pension payment, you probably can afford to take a little more of your portfolio in stocks.
Okay. In general, you do seem to be a believer in free markets and capitalism. Is that a fair
statement?
Wow, that's
about as simply as you can state. Our system has a few warts on it, but I'd have to say that individual initiative and the ability to, I value freedom above equality, I guess is the best way to put it. I think each value is an important value, but in the end, society's better off if you put freedom slightly ahead of equality of outcome.
All right. Well, some people would say that the recent problems that we've had, let's say over the last year, mm-hmm. is because of a lack of oversight by our government and our institutions. I would have two questions. One, do you agree that that is ultimately one of the problems? And two, if so, or even if not, do you see any changes in the oversight that would give you greater confidence that something like we just experienced will not happen again, or at least a vastly reduced chance of happening again?
First of all, I do believe that, people say that when a plane crashes, it's usually a combination of events. It's not, most of the investigators in the end can't point to one single factor that causes an airplane to crash. If you want to carry that analogy over to the economy, I think we had a set of public policies with regard to mortgage finance in particular that caused us all to lose track of the fundamental value of housing. We tended to overvalue housing, and when we were pushing to get 66-68% of our citizens in their own homes, I think we were sort of violating a cardinal rule that you get beyond a certain percentage of the population and they're just not set up to be homeowners. And when we had instilled a set of public policies that were trying to reach this end, we lost track of some of the economic fundamentals. So it was a combination of the ability of Wall Street promoters to sell mortgage investments that really didn't have a whole lot of fundamental value with them, combined with a public policy effort to get more and more people into houses that got us way off track. So, yes, there were regulatory issues. There was a lack of regulatory oversight, particularly in the housing market, and the growth and the ubiquity of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and government financing for housing that I think drove us over the edge. Have I seen any moves or positive policy responses with regard to a new regulatory regime? Not yet.
Well, and we should point out there are proposals currently
yes.
in front of Congress, mm-hmm. Some quite extensive, really to overhaul the whole system.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially.
And particularly give the Fed more responsibility.
It just seems, Charlie, like the fallout keeps coming. We had the situation this week, another $380 million mm-hmm. Ponzi scheme just broke. It. How long can this go on?
Well, I think we're talking sort of about separate issues here. We're talking about a securities regulatory issue with the SEC and these sort of ongoing revelations about Ponzi schemes. And that's simply a failure of enforcement in the area of the Madoff scandal and the issues with the gentleman down in Houston who was found to be, I forget the name of his company.
Stanford,
yes. Those issues are simply a matter of lack of enforcement of existing regulations. With regard to the banking system and the need to bail out so many of these large financial institutions in the fall of last year, I think there were too many regulators. There were some regulators, there was a certain institutions were able to shop for the most lenient regulator. In the example of AIG, for example, AIG was regulated by an entity which was originally designed to regulate and follow small SNLs. So the portfolio and the book of investments in AIG's portfolio was way over the heads of the regulator. So the regulator not only was asleep on the job, they didn't necessarily have the capability of regulating what AIG was up to. So in that case, we didn't have a proper set of regulations, and we're reading and hearing that we're going to try to consolidate some of the regulatory control in the Federal Reserve. I'm not sure if that's a good idea or not, but I do know the Fed has the expertise to regulate. I'm not sure we want to give them the additional powers, but I think you're talking about two different questions there.
But what you're basically saying then is, at least right now, there are not sufficient laws on the books to protect investors, and investors then have to do either their own due diligence or hire a money manager.
Well, I think with regard to the issues like the Ponzi schemes, those regulations exist.
Oh, right. I wasn't even thinking of the Ponzi schemes. I was thinking of bank failures,
right,
and issues that would have an impact on an everyday investor who has a variety of stocks and mutual funds and is trying to stay above water.
I think there are some holes in the quilt of regulation, particularly in the area of banking regulation and the ability of a bank to be over-leveraged. Specific example, we saw institutions like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and Bear Stearns leveraged 28, 30, 35 to 1. In the latter part of the financial boom in 06 and 07. That sort of leverage, almost no matter the environment, is going to blow up at some point. So, and how is an individual investor going to be able to recognize that sort of leverage when a good portion of it is off the balance sheet? That is, those entities had investments which didn't show up in the quarterly SEC filings. So in this case, you didn't have the ability, if you were the smartest analyst in the world and you didn't get a look at these off-balance sheet investments, you wouldn't have been able to make a good evaluation of some of these banks. So yes, there are some holes in the current regulatory regime that need to be fixed. And we're hearing, as Beth said, about some proposals out there, most of them which concentrate the regulatory power in the Federal Reserve. I'm not necessarily in agreement with that, but I think there are some holes that will be filled.
So you do have some confidence that...
Yeah, I think we recognize the problem. Now, the question now is whether we have the political will, and, we're seeing a big pushback on the part of the institutions which don't want to be regulated. I mean, it's, the profit-seeking entities that are existing on Wall Street would certainly not... certainly don't want to be regulated.
Well, so, and you would expect that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the job of the regulators is to recognize where the holes are, recognize where the problems are, and I think they've begun to do that, and then put in place a framework that regulates properly, doesn't overregulate, and gives the enforcement responsibility to the proper entity, and then sees that those regulations are enforced. That's where the SEC fell down. As I said, with regard to these Ponzi schemes, we had all the regulatory structure in place to take care of all those problems, and the laws just weren't enforced.
We are going to take a quick break, Charlie and Jim. We are with Charlie Smith tonight, Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group. It is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
Thank you for joining us tonight. We are talking smart money. I'm Beth Bershock, along with Jim Lang, and our guest tonight, Charlie Smith, Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group. And we're discussing the current market environment. And Charlie, I want to toss out a term that has been really in the headlines for the past month: recession because every time you pick up the business section of the paper, there is conflicting information. Some people think we're out of it. Mm-hmm. Some people think we're going to be in it for a while longer. Can we talk about that first?
Well, let's think in terms of rate of change in the level of economic growth, because that's what really defines recession. The recession, the maximum rate of change, negative rate of change in the economy probably happened in May or June. So basically since the end of May, things have been getting less bad, I guess, as you've seen, I'm sure, as described.
Sure.
So if you want to use, if we're past the point of maximum rate of negative change, the recession has peaked. It's not over yet. Until the rate of economic growth passes from a negative into a positive, but that may be happening right now.
Well, if we're talking about that, then we need to tie in unemployment, because
yes.
If people are saying, okay, the recession is over or we've seen the worst of it, how is it possible that unemployment keeps inching up? And for instance, the latest number that came out was 9.8%. In August, 9.7. So it still is inching up. And if we are technically in recovery or easing out of the recession, how is that continuing to happen?
Well, and the sort of the answer to the quandary there is that the rate of unemployment is a lagging indicator. It tends to lag the measure of the most common measure of GDP growth. So that you can see an economy bottom out, and we won't see the rate of unemployment bottom out for a year, year and a half, till after the economy itself bottoms out.
So are you saying it could be this time next fall when we start to see numbers pick up?
I think we will see job growth. We're still losing 165,000 jobs a month. I think that was the latest number we got in September. And we will probably see job loss on a month-to-month basis through the end of this year at least. And probably sometime in the late first quarter, early second quarter next year is my best guess. We'll start to see new jobs being created, net new jobs created on a monthly basis. Month to month, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs created and lost. The net number is that you see, but the net, there'll be a net positive job number sometime in the early part of next year is our guess. And the big question is, we've lost, from various estimates, 7 million, 8 million jobs in the economy since the recession started. How long is it going to take to get all those jobs back to where we have the same level of employment that we had in the end of November 2007 when the job loss really got going? I've seen various numbers. It may take till 2012, 2013 before we reach those sort of peak levels of employment again. We get the unemployment rate back down to 5.8% where it was at the peak of the last economic upcycle.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying it could actually hit double digits before it starts to decline.
Wouldn't surprise me at all. We're at, 9.8
now?
9.8. So it would only take probably three or four more months of 200,000 job loss a month, along with the continuing increase in the size of the labor force to get us there.
And perhaps the real numbers are higher because a lot of people have just literally given up on
that,
searching
that is
for
true.
A job. And that would be of tremendous concern if you are one of the unemployed people hoping to get called back.
Right.
How big of a concern is that if you are an investor, however? In other words, let's say since March, if the market is up roughly 50% and employment got worse, maybe if you're an investor, the unemployment numbers are not such an important indicator for you.
Well, I think the problem for the investor comes from the political aspects of unemployment. Because believe me, if June of 2010 comes along, and as Beth just mentioned, the unemployment rate is still at 10.1 or even higher, we will see a concerted effort on the part of the Obama administration to do whatever they can in terms of pulling policy levers, whether it be another stimulus package or whatever policy levers they think they need to push to try to get the jobless rate down next year, they're going to do. And from an investor's perspective, it really does create additional risk, because anytime you're not sure what the policymakers are going to do, that uncertainty creates risk from an investor's perspective. One of the most fascinating aspects of this entire decline has been the response on the part of corporate America. Corporate America, in terms of the larger S&P type companies, the bigger businesses in this country, have responded very, very aggressively to this downturn. And that response has involved basically laying people off. Back in January and February, we were seeing 600,000, 700,000 jobs lost per month in that period. So the response on the part of corporate America to the recession has been very aggressive, and it's been very, it's provided a very strong boost to profits. Profits in the first half of this year, the first two quarters of the year, came in way ahead of the analysts' expectations. Now, that's partly because the expectations were set so low. But my point is that from an investor's perspective, a high unemployment rate is a flip side of the aggressive response on the part of corporate America to try to deal with the recession. So from an investor's perspective, high unemployment, as you sort of intimated, is not that big an issue until it becomes a big enough political problem that the policy response in terms of going into debt, printing money, creates a risk for the investor.
Well, let me ask you this. A couple of times you mentioned kind of the intersection of financial markets and politics.
Yes.
And let's
say it's a dangerous intersection.
It is. And I'm not going to try to get political, but I have people coming to my office and they say, hey, look, you know, we're in the middle of two wars. We have the highest deficits we've ever had. We're about to pass some form of a very expensive health care. More and more people are going to be on Medicare. Social Security is just an out of control explosion in terms of the need for money. National security, the risks of terrorism on a number of fronts, nuclear, chemical, all types of things. And they're saying, well, how can the market do well in this type of uncertainty?
Well,
how would you respond to those people who their natural reaction is to go to cash?
Right, sure, exactly. And here's how I frame the entire political economic collision over the past year or so. When we had the financial collapse in the fall of last year, the response from the Bush administration was to do a couple of things. Number one, create the TARP to basically inject capital into the banking system to be sure that we didn't see a collapse in the banking system. Next, it was to, on the part of the Fed, in terms of monetary policy, to basically print enough money to make good on a whole lot of debts that people weren't sure would be good. So the response on the part of the Bush administration really sort of buffered the decline for the financial system and all the people that connected with the financial system. The Obama administration came along a few months later, and their response was to come up with a $787 billion stimulus package, the majority of which so far has gone to support state and local governments. So the Bush administration sort of took care of their constituency. The Democratic Obama administration has come along and sort of taken care of their long-term constituency, a whole lot of local and state, and in many cases, Democratic politicians. But in the middle is the middle class, who essentially is being asked to pay for all this. And in a sense, I think a lot of the angst that we saw in the summer with regard to the big issue about health care and the response from the people saying, look, we're tired of all the bailouts, is because so many people in the middle feel like they've been left out. And in the end, the only way the markets are going to work is if we get the middle class reengaged. And I think that goes to the issue of small business. And a few minutes ago, I said that I think large business has responded quite readily to this decline and done the things they need to do. Well, one of the key constituencies, and particularly with regard to job growth, is small and medium-sized business. And we really have not done a whole lot yet for that constituency, whether it be in terms of policy. And I think we need to do that before we can say, yeah, the markets are going to be completely healthy. Because in the end, as I said before, there's a risk unless if we don't get job growth, there's going to be a further political response on the part of the policymakers, and we don't know where that response will take us in terms of higher inflation, more money printing, more debt. I think the response so far on the part of the private economy and the policymakers has done some good, but before we can be bullish for the long term, we're going to need to see small and medium-sized business back in the game and engaged and growing again. And that's why, you know, we can sort of cheer the rally that we've seen since March, where, you know, prices are up 50, 55% on the S&P. but we're not completely sure that we're going to be able to see good growth a year and a half out, and we're going to be able to sustain this recovery because we need to see small and medium-sized business engaged, and we don't see that yet.
I was just going to ask you that. Do you see any signs that that is happening or any indication that there's going to be some backing for that?
In terms of the policy changes, we may need to see a little bit of a change in the Congress. And again, if we see a 10% unemployment rate in June and July of next year, the swing in Congress may be significant. We may see something like we saw in 94 with regard to the Newt Gingrich contract with America and a big swing in Congress. And at that point, we may see some further efforts on to help small business. But right now, we're not seeing a whole lot on that front. Again, the efforts on the part of big business to try to rationalize their business, the efforts on the part of the stimulus package to help state and local governments, those are helping. The efforts on the part of the Fed to try to buffer the decline in the financial system is helping. But we're not seeing a whole lot in the realm of helping small business yet. And we're going to need to see that before things are going to get better.
And while we're talking about all of the negative impacts of the recession, there is something that I find really fascinating, mm-hmm. which is that in some regards, there has been some success, and one of them has been the rebuilding of personal savings.
Yes, exactly. In the last part of the big financial boom in 2006 and 2007, the savings rate in this country was almost zero.
And which, when you think about that for a second, mm-hmm. doesn't that shock you?
Yes, it's scary.
I know.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the worldwide economy is the fact that the Chinese, one of the most rapidly growing and dynamic economies in the world, they save upwards of 28 to 30% of their income. They are massive savers.
Did you say 30%?
30%, yes. And that's because they don't have the social infrastructure that we do. If you don't have Social Security to rely on, if you don't have the social safety net that we've sort of taken for granted in this country, you're going to save more. So their society has been very good at building up savings. And they therefore have become able to invest very aggressively and become low-cost producers of just about every single manufacturing good you can name. On the other hand, we've been aggressively spending and borrowing. And to get equilibrium in the long term in the world economy, we're going to need to see the savings rate in the U.S. move up and the savings rate in China move down towards somewhere, an equilibrium somewhere between those two numbers. You know, we have a zero, or 6 months ago or 9 months ago, we had zero in the U.S. Today, it's moved up to about 5 or 6%. That's a significant increase.
That is a big increase.
And that really is one way you can define the success of a recession. That sounds like an oxymoron, but recessions are all about rebuilding savings. And this recession so far, we've seen one of the most rapid increases in the savings rate we've ever seen in the history of the data. So the fact that we've begun to rebuild our savings is very much a positive outcome that we've seen so far from this recession. But we've got a lot further to go. And as we eventually rebalance the world economy, become greater savers here, and the people in China in particular, this applies to several developing economies, but in China in particular, they learn to spend a little bit more, will have a better balance in the world economy.
Do you think this rebuilding of savings is something that's going to go on long term, or do you think once the economy eventually does turn around, we're going to go right back to our 0% saving?
That's a great question. One of the things that we're hearing continuously in the media is it's a new normal. You know, people have permanently changed their behavior because they were shocked by the events of the last, 12 to 15 months. I would say yes. I believe that that the spendthrift ways of the baby boomers, the events of the past year or so have really brought people up short, and they've really thought about where they spend. And the fact that we've got so many households that are underwater on their mortgages, I think is sort of forcing that kind of behavior. When you see that there's 110 million households in this country, and about 58% of them have mortgages, so we're looking at maybe 50 million mortgages out there, and 10 to 15 million of them are underwater. That is, the value of the mortgage is more than the value of the house. So, that's a significant number of households out there that are really being forced to take a different financial path. Because their debt load is just too great, and so they need to change their behavior, and they're being forced to change their behavior. So I think we are seeing a permanent change in people's spending behavior. I think that's something that we can pretty much count on.
You mentioned China a couple of times, and I have some clients that are very concerned about China. They're saying, hey, look, they have a $2 trillion surplus as opposed to a deficit.
Right.
We owe them loads of money. They are building infrastructure. Even they are benefiting from the wars that we are waging in Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. because if there is some type of stable government created, that they're going to be the trading partners, in effect taking advantage of all the work and money and
effort
and
that we've done.
Have.
Sure.
And that, you know, there's analogies to the United States, to Rome, and to Great Britain mm-hmm. fighting wars in far-off lands,
right.
you know, right before their decline. Do you think that perhaps that we are potentially a country in decline and that it will eventually be China that will be the top dog? And if so, what kind of impact does that have on today's investor, and will that change your opinion at all about the viability of long-term investments in the stock market?
It all depends on Chinese policy. And, you know, in 1988 and 89, I can remember looking at the cover of Business Week magazine, Japan Inc., and how the Japanese were going to own the world. We're seeing same sorts of angst about China today, as you just sort of brought out. So, you know, there's no doubt the Chinese economy is growing rapidly. They just passed Germany as the third largest economy in the world. It looks like their economy is going to pass Japan within the next 3 years. People are estimating that their GDP would pass the U.S. by 2030. I've seen new estimates it might happen by 2025, where they would become the largest economy in the world. But that's going to depend on policy. That's going to depend on their leadership. If they allow themselves to get sidetracked by an inability to allow people the freedom to speak, for example, you know, they, in a sense, the Chinese leadership has a tiger by the tail. They've basically given their society, their people, a chance to experience, you know, the benefits of free market capitalism, but they have sort of been very careful about allowing the sorts of constitutional freedoms that we take for granted that go with that. And I think unless they are able to sort of let that tiger go in a very careful, measured manner, it's going to turn around and bite them. So in a sense, they've got to begin to expand the political freedoms if they're going to be able to maintain the economic freedoms that they've already begun to build very successfully. So it's a question of policy. If they can manage to gradually basically cede power over to their people over time, I think we will see the Chinese society surpass ours pretty readily. Doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, as long as we can learn to trade with them equitably.
Well, I know Jeremy Siegel has a discussion where he says we want them to succeed because we're getting old and we're going to have stocks and bonds, but we need somebody that's going to make things
sure.
and is going to buy our companies.
Most certainly. When we saw the Chinese oil company attempt to purchase a big U.S. firm here a couple of years back, there was a big political backlash. But believe me, that the Chinese, they want to diversify their investment portfolio. Right now, they've built a gigantic portfolio of U.S. Treasury bonds and mortgage bonds. They want to become owners. As I said when we first sat down here, you're going to generate the greatest return for yourself as an investor, as an owner. So they want to take these reserves that they've built from this gigantic trade surplus and invest them not only in treasury bonds and mortgage bonds, but in businesses and assets around the world. And we had better be willing to allow them to begin to invest in not necessarily the most strategic assets, and we don't necessarily want them buying, you know, titanium plants or our very most valuable electronics technology or biological technologies, but basic technologies, basic assets, we should be perfectly willing to sell them to them at a price. And, you know, the greater freedoms we permit, the greater trade, the greater economic relationships we build with not just the Chinese, but any government around the world, any nation from around the world, the less chance that we're going to end up in conflict with those people.
Charlie and Jim, we are going to take a quick break. Our guest tonight, Charlie Smith, Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group. And we will be back with more discussion on current market environment. It is the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
The Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks, featuring the expert advice of Pittsburgh-based CPA attorney Jim Lang. More coming up on KQV AM 1410. The Lang Money Hour continues on KQV AM 1410. For all of your financial needs, turn to Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, 412-521-2732. Let's talk more smart money.
We are talking smart money tonight. I'm Beth Bershock, along with Jim Lang, and our guest in the studio tonight, Charlie Smith, Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group. Just a few minutes ago, we were discussing a lot of signs of the recession, and something that, Charlie, you claim is no longer the big story. Declining home prices for a long time, for months, that has been the huge story, and we even touched on that a few minutes ago. But you claim now that the key indicator is actually the rate of increase in bank lending.
Yes, exactly. Beginning in late 06, early 07, the focus was, okay, people didn't believe that house prices could decline, and we found out over the past 3 years that most certainly even a 35 or 40% decline in the value of your home is a possibility. But that story is behind us now, and the response on the part of policymakers to that decline and all the fallout from it was to begin to try to print money and get that money into the system to try to reflate the system. Well, that response has really not gotten a lot of traction yet, because the Fed has created a whole bunch of money and given it to the banks, but the banks have not yet begun to lend it out. And it's only when that money begins to get lent into the system and it begins to generate economic growth that we will begin to have a recovery. So the question is, what variables, what indicators do you need to monitor to know whether this money is starting to be lent out and the economy is beginning to get traction? So we're closely following the velocity of money, which is simply the rate of GDP growth divided by the amount of money in the economy. We're following the size of the Fed's balance sheet. And we're just generally trying to make sure that we're staying on top of the financial variables that let us know when the banks are starting to lend again. It can be as simple as looking at the quarterly reports that the banks file with the regulators about the size of their loan books. When the top 20 banks in this country have seen their loan portfolios shrink by about 5 to 6% over the past 6 months. That's a pretty simple indicator that the banks are still hoarding cash.
So, what is the explanation for that?
Well, the banks aren't certain what the loss rates are going to be on the loans that they already have on the books. That's the simplest explanation for that. They are uncertain about how severe the losses are going to be on the loans that they've already written. And they want to be sure that their rate of earnings and their ability to provide reserves for those loans is good enough. So they're very careful with whatever cash doesn't come in the door. They're not as quick to lend it out as they were 4 or 5 years ago, because they don't know just how bad the holes, you know, the Swiss cheese is in their existing portfolio. And there are some segments of the market that you know, the consensus is that commercial real estate, for example, is really just in maybe the third inning of their decline. So there are a lot of concerns out there about just how bad the loss ratios are going to be on these loan portfolios, so the banks are sitting on this cash.
I have heard you mention this issue of how bad are the toxic assets, mm-hmm. if you will.
Right.
And I know that even months ago, you were saying that the answer to that question, whatever it is, will help clarify.
Exactly.
Do we have any indication yet? I mean, so you were saying this 6 months ago. Do we have any further information that would help us in this?
We do. When you're referring specifically to the toxic assets, those are connected primarily to mortgage loans.
Mm-hmm.
And we've learned over the past year or so, particularly now that house prices have begun to level off after a 35% decline, we've learned that most of the mortgage-backed securities of good quality are worth somewhere around 55 to 65 cents on the dollar. That's what we're finding out. And so that issue of mortgage-backed securities in the housing realm is pretty well discounted in prices. What's a problem now for most of the regional banks, and not the top 20 banks necessarily, but the banks from 20 to 100 maybe, is their commercial real estate portfolios and their commercial loan portfolios. That's where the uncertainty still remains, because a lot of the regional banks, community banks, had built their loan book with real estate loans, and commercial real estate loans. So a lot of the bankers have sort of got a handle on how bad their residential mortgage problem is, but they're not completely certain what the loss rate is going to be on their commercial loan portfolios and their commercial real estate loans as well.
Well, I know I was just considering moving our office, and I was surprised at the quality and how much good commercial real estate was available.
The numbers just came out today with regard to the price declines in the commercial mortgage-backed securities market and the rates of decline of office rents, for example, around the country. Some of the major metro areas, San Diego, year-over-year rents down 10%, New York City down 12%.
Which is stunning for New York City.
Exactly. I mean, everybody viewed that as, the property that would never decline in value. But I guess as we've learned the last 5 years, you can never say never.
Well, let me ask you this. Traditionally, I think that you haven't been terribly bullish about real estate investments for the long term. Do you think that might be, and I know that you're somewhat opportunistic, mm-hmm. that is, you like to buy things when they are cheap.
Yes.
Do you think that might be an opportunity, let's say in the next couple of years, that when we start seeing some defaults and we start seeing some
yes.
problems with commercial real estate, that maybe that might be a little bit more interesting?
Commercial real estate, simply another form of equity investing. You can lend against real estate. You can go out and buy a mortgage. But in my case, as another form of equity investment, it obviously is all about location and price. But in the next 3 or 4 years, we're going to see a whole lot of properties that were way overloaded with debt during the commercial mortgage boom. That debt's going to need to be refinanced. I've seen various estimates, $500 billion to $600 billion in commercial mortgages that are going to need to be refinanced, that were 3 and 5 year loans that were written between 2006 and 2007, that are going to need to be refinanced, and the money's not going to be there. So a lot of those properties will go back to the lenders, and those lenders will be selling them off, and there's going to be a terrific opportunity in certain markets in commercial real estate that we'll see a lot of. We already have seen a lot of vulture funds set up to buy that stuff. And for example, in Miami, entire condominium buildings.
Oh,
that's
sold an off. Amazing story there in Miami.
Yes.
Yeah. There is one building where there's still one resident.
And, a couple hundred units.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It has been very interesting to watch that.
Yes.
We've been talking about some of these indicators with the economic recovery, Charlie. Are there any other things that the average investor should be looking at?
Well, besides the beginnings of growth within the loan portfolios of the banks and the velocity of money, how the money within the economy is beginning to turn over at a higher rate, as I said before, I think the ability of small business to get their footing and recognize that the end is not near and you don't have to lay off your entire staff, and I'm not sure where that comes from. If you remember, back during the recovery in 2002 and 2003, there were tax cuts, there were aggressive efforts to help small business, and I've been reading in the past week or so that the Obama administration is looking at some sort of a significant tax credit for hiring. That may be a wonderful change, but I think we're going to need to see the classic engine of job growth and economic growth in this economy, small business, treated a little bit better, and before we're going to see signs of a real recovery. As I said, the recovery we've seen so far is more of just a rebound from a fear-driven collapse and support of the system by the Fed and the Treasury, and it's really not an organic sort of risk-taking type recovery yet. It may become one, but we're going to need to get small and medium-sized business in the game before we really can say it's a true recovery.
Could you tell us a couple resources for readers if they are, let's say, information hungry?
Okay.
And obviously there's all kinds of stuff that you probably don't think is too credible. What are some of the sources that you think might be good for readers in the investment area?
Well, let's talk specifically about a couple of the indicators that I was using. If we want to tell people you know, what we think are key indicators, we need to tell them where they can get them. With regard to the velocity of money, with regard to the Fed's balance sheet, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve's balance or website is a great place to go. Specifically, the website of the St. Louis Fed. And if you just go to Google and type in St. Louis Federal Reserve, it'll direct you right to it. That's a wonderful source of sort of the baseline data that'll give you an idea of, you know, which way the economy's going. With regard to, you know, and the data is unbelievably cheap and unbelievably prevalent. It's amazing. When I first got in this business in 1983, the data that I use on a day-to-day basis in my business of managing money was costing me $60,000-$70,000 a year. I can get that same information for 1/10 to 1/15 of that cost today. So the data is almost free. The information, and you don't really build value in your investing process by amassing more data or getting it more quickly than someone else. You add value by putting a perspective, having a perspective on the world, and most importantly, the ability to keep your head when the world about you is losing its own ability to invest, you know, rationally. But in terms of sources of information, you know, the Federal Reserve is a wonderful place for basic data about the economy.
And what about your website? Would that be a good source for people?
Well, it'll give you sort of a roadmap for the basics of investing. You know, the idea, the questions you need to ask of someone who you might think about hiring as a financial advisor. That's something that you'll find on our website.
Those are some that's good advice.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And what is that website address?
It's www.fortpittcapital, all one word, .com.
Okay.
Pretty simple.
Hey, Charlie, thank you so much for joining us tonight. We really appreciate you taking the time to join us live in the studio. Charlie Smith, who is the Chief Investment Officer of Fort Pitt Capital Group, and again, their website is www.fortpittcapital.com. And I want to, we have a couple of minutes left. We have, Jim, coming up in the next month and a half, we have a couple of workshops that we're going to be presenting, and this is all about a big tax law change that's coming up January 1st. It's less than 3 months away.
It's going to be nirvana. we're talking about tax-free dynasties.
You've been waiting for this.
So I have, literally, for years.
For so long. But essentially what's happening on January 1st, 2010, is that all taxpayers will be eligible for Roth IRA conversions. And up until this point, there has been an income restriction. So it's opening up huge on January 1st.
Up to now, people could not make a Roth IRA conversion if their modified adjusted gross income was more than $100,000.
So there are a lot of people that are going to suddenly be eligible for this.
Right.
Okay, so we're going to be covering this, and we are also going to be covering a big opportunity for seniors in 2009 to make a Roth IRA conversion. And our next workshop, and it's free. This is absolutely free. It's Saturday, October 24th, Holiday Inn, Mossside Boulevard in Monroeville. And we have two times, 9:30 to 11:30 or 1 to 3. And I will say this, the last one that we did, which was in August, and we did a bunch of these in the spring, they reach capacity. We have limited seating. So if you would like to attend this, I would make reservations as soon as possible. And you can do that by calling 800-748-1571. 800-748-1571. Tell us which session you would like to go to, the morning or the afternoon. Then we have another one coming up on November 21st, which is a Saturday as well. And that time, we're going to be back in the Cranberry area at the Four Point Sheraton. Seriously, Jim is so excited about this issue. You have to come and hear this. And we always give a free copy of Jim's book, the second edition of Retire Secure, to every attendee. So again, our next one is October 24th. It's in Monroeville, 800-748-1571. And you can find out more on our website, which is retiresecure.com. Thanks again to Charlie Smith for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, we will be back again in 2 weeks, another edition of the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks.
Thanks for listening to the Lang Money Hour, where smart money talks. Portions of the audio that you just heard will be posted online at retiresecure.com. You can also find a list of upcoming events and topics at retiresecure.com. To seek personally or to speak to a member of his dedicated staff at Lang Financial Group in Squirrel Hill, call 412-521-2732. Join us again in 2 weeks when we talk more smart money.